Open your Bible, please, to the book of Esther. The book of Esther. That's Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and then Job, Psalms, Proverbs, the book of Esther. And Esther chapter 1, verse 1, we'll get right into the book of Esther. Esther is a great book to read. When we talk about reading and studying the Bible, the Bible is such a fun book to read. There's so many great things in the Bible that are fun and inspiring and wonderful. And you can read these stories over and over and over again and always get something new out of them and get inspired from them. Bible study and Bible reading doesn't have to be laborious and boring. And the book of Esther is a great example of a book that just warms your heart when you read it and the old rah-rah coming through. It's exciting. It's fun. The book is at the time period the same as Ezra and Nehemiah. I, again, personally think that the chronology that is so well documented in the book on Bible chronology by Martin Anstey is accurate. If you'll look at your Oxford Bible Atlas, page 19, and you see the list of the Persian kings, Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes. When you see Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes, these are all titles. They're not names. They're not personal names. Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, they're all titles. And different titles were given to different kings, and different titles were even given to the same kings at different time periods. And the understanding that Martin Anstey has of this time period that I agree with is that Darius, this man 521 to 485 called Darius the First, is the man that is mentioned in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and that the three of these, the man Ezra, the man Ezra, the man Nehemiah, and the queen Esther would be contemporaneous during the time of Darius the First. Many, in fact, I would say most modern chronologers don't agree with that, and you can study it out and see what you think on your own. In any case, the identity of this king is not necessary for enjoying and seeing the greatness of God working in this story, which is about what we're going to do. So in chapter 1, verse 1, this is what happened during the reign of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Cush. Now, Cush in the Bible is what we know as Ethiopia today. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And Susa, by the way, if you'll look in your Oxford Bible Atlas, you can see exactly where this account occurred. If you look in your Oxford Bible Atlas to the page 79, it's page 70 and 79, you'll see the Persian Empire, and you can see how broad the Persian Empire was. In fact, it just takes up basically this entire map, and you can see Cush, which we now know as Ethiopia, down in the continent of Africa. So he's reigning from the Indus River, India, all the way to Cush. Verse 3, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persian Media, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and splendor and glory of his majesty. Now, you think you've been to a party. Here's this 180-day party. He displays the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty for 180 days. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. That's a noble gesture on the part of the king. They certainly had gone out of their way. You know what it's like to throw a party in your house And all of the little inconveniences of running around, the last minute cleaning, the special preparations of food, how long it takes. And for some half a year here, the people in the Palace of Susa have put up with this seemingly unending parade of various ambassadors and officials from these provinces. And so at the end of this 180-day period, the king throws a little party for 7 days for the people that are in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Golly, what a gorgeous setup this would be. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. It is intriguing that if you study ancient cultures, different cultures had drinking customs. In some cultures, you'd have, if the king takes a drink, you've got to take a drink. With the Romans would have a man called the governor of the feast, and then the governor of the feast would set the drinking rules. And if you wanted to be in the feast, then you drank according to the rules of the governor. And here the king says, no, I want everybody to do what they want to do. Everybody can drink in their own way. Now, while this banquet is going on, verse 9, Queen Vashti, and she was Xerxes' queen at the time, also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes, because it would be a pretty usual procedure that you wouldn't have a banquet where people are mixing like this and getting drunk, drinking a lot of wine, where the women and the men would be mixed up. That maybe occasionally you would, but that would not necessarily be the custom. So Queen Vashti has got a banquet for the women in the royal palace of the King Xerxes. Now on the seventh day, now remember this feast is going to last 7 days. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, this is the end of the bash. 187 days of partying, and this is the last day, and King Xerxes has had an awful lot of wine, and he's in high spirits. He commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Now, Queen Vashti here is really put on the spot, because the king wants to drag her in before all these men in the palace to show off her beauty. Well, typically she would live a very secluded lifestyle, and these men in the palace would not get a chance to see her very often, certainly. And certainly not in the condition they're in now, that they're drunk. And so, in one sense, she has to come. She's the queen. She has to obey the king's royal command. On the other hand, if she does come, she's going to be personally embarrassed. And furthermore, the king, when he finally sobers up, is going to realize that he's made himself a laughingstock. I mean, for years to come, you'll hear things around the palace like, you remember that time that king got so drunk he brought Vashti in and dragged her around in front of the men of the palace? Ha ha, boy, that was wild, wasn't it? So the queen, she's stuck. If she goes, it's a mistake. If she doesn't go, it's a mistake. The problem is her husband, the king, is drunk and he's doing something stupid. So she has to make a choice, and the choice she makes is, I'm not going to go. Verse 13, since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke to the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king, all these guys here, the seven nobles of Persia and Media, who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. And remember, he's really angry. He's furious.
According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her.
And Mamunkin replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. This is quite a statement. He stands up and says, you know, King, Vashti hasn't just wronged you. She's wronged every noble and all the people from India to Ethiopia. Now, what's his logic for saying that? Verse 17, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, well, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come, so I don't have to obey you, O husband, O lord, O whatever you are. And so there's going to be this huge women's liberation movement, and Mamunkin doesn't want one. And neither, apparently, does King Xerxes. This very day, goes on Mamunkin, verse 18, this very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility, who have heard about the queen's conduct, will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. The kingdom would never be the same if this behavior of Vashti is allowed to be unpunished. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And this kind of is the punishment fits the crime, okay? You won't see him now, then you can't ever see him. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. By the way, this little section in here about Vashti having to obey the king and all the women having to obey the nobles and obey, this is just absolutely brutally honest about the condition of women in the ancient world. Remember, in our study in Genesis, we saw Adam and Eve, that it was bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, she shall be called Isha, woman, because she was taken from man. And God said, let them have authority, let them rule. And then after the fall, God looks at Eve and says, your desire shall be to your husband and he shall rule over you. And through history, because men have been bigger and stronger, and the land was won, fought for and kept by battle, by sword and by club, women were usually brutalized and used and shoved around and taken captive and in generally made to do what men wanted. And you simply see that here. It is significant that in Christ Jesus, there is neither male nor female in Christ Jesus. Jesus Christ is, there's unity in the body, and both men and women look to Jesus Christ as Lord for guidance. But here, the people didn't want the women to be liberated. So there's a decree that Vashti should not come into the king anymore to get to see the king. Verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Mamunkin proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should rule over his own household. That's got to be funny. You can imagine a guy getting a letter. The king proclaims you should rule in your house. And the guy's reading it going, huh? Where's the king coming from? What's the king been doing back up there in Susa anyway? Chapter 2. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Now the king sobers up, and he kind of comes to his senses, and he remembers Vashti and what she had done. I really put her on the spot, didn't I? And what he had decreed about her. Like, I can't see her anymore. And Vashti was far and away his favorite wife. And we'll see here from the record, again, the wonderful honesty of God's word here, that the queen got her position because of her beauty and what she could do sexually for the king. And if you remember, the reason that the king even wanted to bring Vashti in to the nobles was not because she was such a wonderful lady, but because she was lovely to look at, and the king's proud of her, and he's going to show her off like maybe a zookeeper would show off a prize animal. You know, he's got her shut up in the harem there, and he gets to see her and enjoy her, and he's going to drag her out to show her to all the nobles, and now all of a sudden, here's this kind of wonderful prize of his that he can no longer see. And so he's a little disturbed with himself, and I'm sure he's just kind of upset with life in general and not a fun person to be about around right now. And in verse 2, the king's personal attendants proposed. And this is a great, I mean, the personal attendants knew exactly what the problem was, and they needed something to distract the king and see if they could replace his prize. So in verse 2, the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." In other words, okay, king, let's have a nationwide India to Ethiopia beauty contest. We'll drag in all the gorgeous women. You get to try them all out, and the one that you like can be queen. And this advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. And you can just see, I mean, the king here is occupied with his harem. Verse 5. "Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, who had been carried away into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Among those taken captive with by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Now Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he'd brought up because she had neither father nor mother, and they were killed or died, and the Bible doesn't say how. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and feature, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought into the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem." Now, this certainly wasn't what Esther probably had in mind for her life. I mean, Esther, as a young girl growing up, she thinks about what other young girls think about. "I'm going to get married to this man. We're going to settle down. We'll have a family." But now the king's beauty pageant is on, and somebody noticed that Esther was a wonderful-looking girl, and so, swoop, off she goes to the palace. And now she's part of the harem and would have nothing to say about that. It was simply something the king did. And this shows tremendous resiliency in Esther. She doesn't jump out a palace window, doesn't commit suicide. She takes things in stride and has faith in God. In verse 9, "The girl pleased him." This girl pleased Haggai. Esther pleased Haggai and won his favor. "Immediately, he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food." In other words, got her through the red tape. "He assigned to her seven maidens, selected from the king's palace, and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem." Well, sure, I mean, there's going to be, how many women are there? Well, there were 127 provinces. So if you took one girl from each province, there'd be 127. Nobody really knows how many women there were. I think it is it's Josephus, I believe, who says there were probably around 400, and he would have had access to documents that at his day and age would have been somewhere around half a century old, certainly much better handle on the probabilities than we do today. So 400 would seem about right. Three girls per province, And you can imagine if there's 400 rooms in a big hotel, there's going to be some that are on the lower floor that are hot and a little stuffy, and then some that are bigger rooms, nicer rooms overlooking the fountain in the back type of thing. And Esther, in the harem apartments, got the best place because she had pleased Haggai. And Esther is walking with God. Verse 10, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Well, why didn't he go in and say, "Hi, Esther"? Why didn't he go in and find out how she was doing? Well, he wouldn't have come out. He didn't just walk into the king's harem at any time he wanted to. The harem was off limits, so she's got to walk back and forth outside and just kind of pick up a piece of news here and a piece of news there. Verse 12, before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Sheshgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. Now, this is brutally honest sexually. This is exactly how the king selected his wife. He had these 400 women. They were perfumed and fed and whatever else they went through. It's called beauty treatments for a year. And then she got one night with the king. She would go in the evening, and once she'd had intercourse with the king, in the morning she would go to a different part of the harem. And the way that that she pleased the king sexually that one night would determine her future. She could be queen of the whole realm, as it was in the case that ended up as Esther. She could be just one woman that the king liked occasionally. In other words, if she was good enough that the king remembered her name. Or she could be just a forgotten girl that's going to be assigned to the harem for the rest of her days and just kind of live in seclusion until she'd die in the harem. This is brutally honest sexually. It is interesting to me that when Christians handle the Bible, many times they don't handle it honestly. And that's a problem because it just seems that in America today, people tend to go to one extreme or the other with sex. Either they are prudish about sex and embarrassed about sexual things, or they're lustful and licentious and loose. And the Bible has a beautiful balance, and particularly concerning the man and woman in the marriage relationship and sex in the function of the marriage relationship and in companionship, beautifully balanced. And what I'm talking about when I say prudish or embarrassed, it's, for example, like when Samson was taken out in front of the Philistines, and the NIV translates and says, "Bring Samson out so he may entertain us." Like he's going to do stand-up comedy. No, he was sexually tortured and abused. And the Bible is brutally honest. The text is, the Hebrew text is anyway, about what would happen to Samson in a situation like that. And here we see in the Scripture, the Bible is brutally honest about what Esther had. We can't pretend here that Esther had great intelligence and great wisdom, and it was her knowledge of current events and her ability to speak from a podium and her great knowledge of science or whatever that impressed the king. Esther may have had all those things. It's true. Esther may have had all those things. But what the king was interested in was one night in bed. In verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. Now this is really, you see great intelligence and planning on the part of Esther all the way through the book of Esther. Remember how verse 13 said, anything a girl wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. I'm sure that there were all kinds of sexual paraphernalia available in the ancient world. You know, all kinds of stimulators and exciters and fancy clothes, etc., etc., that are available now. You can read about them in some of the sex magazines. And, of course, they didn't have electric motors and batteries, but all kinds of doodads. And a woman could take anything she wanted. She got one shot with a king. Now, Esther knew that the one who knew the king's sexual preferences best was Haggai. I mean, Haggai kept the harem. Haggai would be the guy that the king would talk to about, boy, I really like that. I really hated this. So she goes to Haggai and she just says, well, what would you suggest? And Haggai tells her, what a great move. And then she takes what Haggai suggested. What you just learn whenever you can. Boy, that's great intelligence and sharpness on Esther's part. Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She must have been just sharp and godly and kind and wonderful and yet firm and strong. What a tremendous woman of God we have here. Verse 16, she was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month of the month Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. Now she was brought into his palace, remember, in the 3rd year. So she's been 4 years in the palace and she hadn't even seen the king yet. Hanging around the harem for 4 years. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women. She won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins, which obviously she did in that one night. So he set a royal crown on her head, made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gives this great banquet, proclaims a holiday. Verse 19, when the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officials who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. Again, look at the sharpness of Esther. Esther could have gone into the king and said, hey, Xerxes, I found out about a plot to assassinate you. But you know something? She's maxed out her potential. She can't get any higher. She has been promoted to the highest position a woman can attain in the kingdom. So there's no reason for her to do this. But on the other hand, she can give great help to Mordecai. So she goes into the king because she's got access to the king. If Mordecai told somebody else, then they'd probably take credit for finding the plot out. Remember how the man who brought Daniel to the king said, I have found a man that can interpret the king's dream. So Mordecai simply told Esther. Esther told the king, but certified Mordecai's name and said Mordecai was the one who found out about this and is turning this in. Verse 23, when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. Now, the hanging of the Persian world, the Assyrian world, was an impaling. It's not like we, where you throw a guy up, you know, you throw a rope over a tree and put a rope around the guy's neck and hang him. When the Bible here in the Persian Empire or the Assyrian Empire uses hang, it's called hang because your limp body would hang from the stake that you were impaled on. And they would usually impale you alive, just whoosh, right on the stake like a skewer. This was recorded in the book of the Annals in the presence of the king. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Now, what's the problem? Mordecai is honoring the king, and he's a Persian, he's a pagan. Mordecai would honor other men, and they were pagans. What is it about Haman? What is it about Haman that Mordecai won't honor? Well, chapter 3, verse 1 says that Haman, son of Hammedatha, was an Agagite. And if you remember, Agag was an Amalekite king in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And it is extremely reasonable and probable that Haman was related through descendancy to these Amalekite kings that we saw in 1 Samuel, and certainly would have been an Amalekite. Furthermore, we learned from Esther chapter 2 in verse 5 that Mordecai was a Benjamite, and Saul, a Benjamite, the first king of Israel, was the one entrusted to destroy the Amalekites. So that explains why Mordecai, a Judean, a Benjamite, was not going to bow down to an Agagite, one of the Amalekite descendants that God had said, I'm going to have war with them forever, and I'm going to destroy them from the face of the earth. And we will pick up the story of Esther on the other side of this tape. We're in Esther, chapter 3. And Mordecai is not bowing down before Haman, and Haman finds out about it. In verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. And this is a part of why Esther is in the Bible. Here again is the devil, the adversary, the enemy, trying to destroy the line to Jesus Christ. And you can see the adversary working inside Haman. I mean, he's mad at Mordecai. Mordecai won't bow down. But to destroy every Jew? Why would you do that? You do that because, again, the adversary is working in him, because the adversary does not want to come face to face with Jesus Christ. So what he does is he goes into the king. Well, in verse 7, in the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, in the presence of Haman, to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. And Haman said to King Xerxes, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. Bunch of lies? Absolutely, a pack of lies. What do you mean they didn't obey the king's laws? Of course they did. So he says it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. 10,000 talents of silver? That it's 66 pounds per talent? That's just an immense amount of money. And you can see here the evil and the way the adversary is working in Haman's life. And, of course, the king, he'd be happy to get 10,000 talents. And, of course, the way they're going to do this is described in verse 13. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, on the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So if you kill off all the Jews in the entire kingdom and you take their goods, then you'd have money to give to the kingdom. And also, of course, it's a great motivator, because You can get people to kill their next-door neighbors if after they kill them, they get to run off with their house and their animals and their silverware and et cetera, et cetera. So, again, Haman is using greed here to help spur this plot on. In verse 15, spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Sure, they're bewildered, because they've heard about how horrible these people, the Jews, are. But they live next to him, and they say, "What, Mr. Goldman? He's a nice guy. What do you mean he doesn't obey the king's laws? What do you mean he's worthy of death? He's a nice guy. He's a pillar in the community. He does this and this." So the people in the kingdom are perplexed. See, the king is pretty much out of touch with the kingdom, and he relied on people like Haman to give him accurate information. And the king would be ruling from India to Ethiopia, and he's got to have advisors who give him accurate information. Here Haman has fed him a pack of lies, and he's believed Haman. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In the same way that Nehemiah was afraid when he was sad in the king's presence, in the same way that Solomon's attendants were happy, remember the Queen of Sheba, how happy are your attendants? No one was allowed to drag their personal problems into the presence of the king, and you simply couldn't go into the king's palace clothed in sackcloth, which was a sign of mourning. In every province, verse 3, to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and to explain it to her, and he told him to urge her. Mordecai told Hatak to urge Esther to go into the king's presence and beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. You know, this guy Hatak is one of the unsung heroes of the scripture, because what do you think Haman would have paid for information that the king's favorite wife was one of those he was trying to destroy? Oh, I'll bet you he would have paid lots and lots of money. Hatak could have been a millionaire and retired overnight here, but he's going to stay faithful to Esther. Of course, in verse 9, Hatak went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said, and she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the golden scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." Now the king is in his inner chambers, and Esther simply hasn't seen the king in a month. And for Mordecai to say, "Well, you've got to go into the king and plead and see if you can get this situation straightened out," Esther said, "Well, you know, to go in there is certain death unless the king were to extend the golden scepter, and I don't know what he's doing in there, and I haven't been called." Now, I'm sure the king hadn't been celibate for the last 30 days. He's just having fun with other women of his harem as well as taking care of court matters. In verse 12, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you were in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. What great faith he had. The promises of God to Abraham will stand. The line of the promised seed will be preserved. Absolutely. We today can stand firmly on those promises of God that we have. And Mordecai was standing on the promises that he had. He said, look, if you remain silent, relief and deliverance will arise from another place. That's the word of the Lord. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to the royal position for such a time as this. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather together all the Jews who were in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I die, I die. What tremendous faith on the part of this woman. What a beautiful heart for God. What a genuine, sane perspective on life. You know, if we die doing our best for God, so be it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they said, even if God's not going to deliver us, we'd rather be in heaven with all the rewards than bow down and worship to your stupid image, king. Daniel, he knew he was going to be thrown into the den of lions. He knew the law couldn't be changed. He went and prayed anyway. And here's Esther, and she said, you're exactly right. If God's word is going to be fulfilled, who knows but what I am here right now to do that. And she said, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If I die, I die. Big deal. So what if I didn't go in and I wasn't discovered? What have I got, 80, 90 more years? Hip, hip, hooray. Ladies and gentlemen, this life at its best is so short compared to eternal life. And the tremendous heart and love and believing faith of this woman, I'll go into the king. If I perish, so be it. I perish. So Mordecai went away, carried out all Esther's instructions. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes. Now, come on, wait a minute. Look at the text here. She put on her royal robes. Do you think Esther normally went running around the palace in her underwear? The text is flagging you to something. Esther's normal everyday wear would be wonderful. She's the queen from India to Ethiopia. She just especially dressed herself up for this occasion, and I'll bet you she thought through. Remember, her life depends upon the king liking her when he sees her. I'll bet you she thought through everything the king, every pair of shoes the king had ever made a comment about, every brooch or ring that the king had ever given her or made a comment about. She put on her royal robe. She decked herself out, stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. Now the king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of his scepter. Then the king asked, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you. And half the kingdom, it was an idiom, and it meant no reasonable request refused. You'll see this phrase come up again in the book of Esther, and if you remember, in the court of Herod, in the time of Jesus Christ, this is the exact phrase that Herod used of Salome when she danced before King Herod, and he said, I will give you what you want, up to half the kingdom. And she said, I want the head of John the Baptist on a plate. And because of his oath, he had to kill John the Baptist. Actually, he didn't have to kill John the Baptist. He could have said, wait a minute, nope, sorry, murder is out. But he got pressured into it because of pride. Pride has caused the downfall of so many men. But here the king says, what is it? Up to half the kingdom, in other words, no reasonable request denied, it will be given you. Verse 4, if it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king together with Haman, come today to the banquet I have prepared for him. Bring Haman at once, the king said, so that we may do what Esther asks. Again, when we look at the banquet, we've got to remember here what the king normally ate. The king that reigned from India to Ethiopia never ate anything he didn't want to eat. It's not like he'd walk into his royal dining room and sit down and look at the meal and say, beans again? Leftovers again? I mean, every meal the king ate was exactly what he wanted to eat. So what then the big deal is about this banquet? Put the emphasis in verse 4 on the word I. If it please the king, said Esther, let the king together with Haman come today to a banquet I have prepared. I haven't seen you in 30 days. I have something I need to say. Bring Haman at once, the king said, so that we may do what Esther asks, because he knows that Esther has risked her life for this thing, and it obviously isn't just to feed him. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, now what is your petition? It'll be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be granted. Esther replied, my petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh's wife, Haman boasted to them. Sounds like Saul. And he boasts to them. And then verse 13 he says, but all these things that I have give me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate. His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a gallows built 75 feet high. It's like a 7-story building. And ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to dinner and be happy. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. And I'll bet those guys worked all night long to get a 75-foot gallows built with a big old stake on top so they could hang Mordecai where everybody could see it. In chapter 6, verse 1, that night the king could not sleep. I'll bet not. His favorite wife, Esther, has risked her life to tell him something. But whatever it is that she has to tell him, that she's going to risk her life over telling him, it's not so important that it can't wait. What an amazing riddle. I mean, Samson riddle pales in comparison to this. And you can see the king. She risked her life. It's got to be important, but it can wait. It can wait, but she risked her life. And he's trying to work this thing back and forth, and he's so pestered, he just can't sleep. He ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. He says, there's got to be something going on in the kingdom she knows about that I don't. So he's getting the Chronicles of the kingdom read to him to try to find out about his kingdom and back up, see if he's missed anything. And it was recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. Ooh, what a mistake. What a mistake. Because the assassination was the chief way of removing kings in that time period. I mean, if you look at the kings of ancient history, there were a few old kings who died of natural causes, whose sons took over, but it was so common in the ancient world to assassinate the ruler and for somebody else to take over. Well, how are you going to get anybody to stick their neck out and reveal an assassination plot? Because if you have just the subject in the kingdom, if he keeps his mouth shut, if it's not successful, that's no skin off his teeth, and if it is successful, he hasn't made anybody mad. But if somebody sticks his neck out and says, hey, King, there's an assassination plot, well, if the assassination plot is successful, then that guy's going to be killed too. So the only way that a king could be assured that anybody in the kingdom would stick his neck out and reveal an assassination plot is if everybody else in the kingdom saw how richly he was rewarded when he did. So in verse 3, when the king heard nothing's been done for him, you can imagine what happened in his mind. He's like, whoa, this is a major, major error. Especially now that he's so upset and worried and wondering what's going on with Esther. In verse 4, the king said, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he directed for him. Great timing, Haman. His attendants answered, Haman's standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head, and the crest would be on the horse's head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor, lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Well, that tells you something about Haman. Haman wants this done for himself. He's so prideful. Now, he rather than money or land, he'd rather want everybody in the kingdom to know that he's the man the king would honor, and he gets to ride that king's horse and wear the king's clothes. Just pride oozing out all over this man. Verse 10, go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse, and do just as you've suggested for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. And you can see Haman's face, just his mouth drop open and his eyes grow wide. Do not neglect anything you've recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, verse 12, afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. I mean, he didn't get any particular thrill out of wearing the king's clothes. But Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief, and he told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall is started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. Now, when the king's eunuchs arrived to get Haman, was Haman ready to go to the banquet? No, not hardly. He had his head covered in grief. He wasn't dressed for the occasion. So he's got to now take some time to get ready. And meanwhile, the king's eunuchs hang around Mordecai's house. What around Mordecai's house is unusual to talk about? You can see the king's eunuchs. Now, there's something you don't see every day, Harold. A 75-foot hanging post. And then they get to talking about, what in the world is this thing here for? I mean, this is, you know, pretty ostentatious, 75 feet. Who in the world is Haman going to kill? And then they talk back and forth, oh, Haman wanted to kill him. This would be the eunuchs that are waiting around outside for Haman to be ready, talking about what's going on. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and as they were drinking wine on that second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be granted. Queen Esther answered, if I found favor with you, O king. And I'll bet you said that very slowly, to let the king answer in his mind, yes, you have found favor with me. And if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. Grant me my life. Now you can imagine how this hit the king ruling from India to Ethiopia. Somebody's trying to kill his queen. He's already lost one favorite when he was drunk and somebody recommended he do the wrong thing. And now somebody's trying to kill the queen. You can bet. I mean, I'll bet he turned red as a beet. I'll bet the hackles came up on the back of his neck. He's just bristling when he hears this. I want my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king, which again is great love and respect shown in her voice and what she says. Tremendous tact here that Queen Esther would use, starting out with, if I have found favor, and now, you know, if we'd been sold as slaves, king, that would have been too little a thing to bother you. Verse 5, King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman, pointing at him as he sat right at the table with the king. Look at the boldness in this woman's life. Look at her willingness to stand up for the truth. She didn't bow down. She didn't crater. She came right at the problem head on. That's God, like he said to Joshua, be strong and courageous so you can do the word and not cave in and crater and not do it. The enemy is this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Now, sure, he would have been. Remember, the whole premise of killing the Jews was based on a lie. He said they weren't profitable. And now we know Mordecai was a Jew, and he was certainly profitable, and the king even knew that. The relationship between the king and Mordecai already, that the king knew exactly what Mordecai had done, and also with Esther and what Esther had done for him. So Haman knew his lie was exposed. He was in trouble. He's terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. He was so angry he couldn't even stay there. By the way, this was a breach of custom. You just didn't get up and march away from the table. Even today, in American table manners, you're supposed to ask who's ever running the table to be excused. And the king just blows out of the room. Verse 7, the last part. But Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, you see, the king's behavior was indicative of exactly what he was going to do. Realizing the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. So you can see him now approaching Esther and saying, let me live, let me live. And Queen Esther saying, no, no. And just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she's here with me in the house? You know, it's bad enough he wants to kill her off, but he's going to molest her first? As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, this was a sign that even the eunuchs knew it was a death penalty. See, once a man was condemned to die, a condemned criminal no longer had the right, according to custom, to even look on nobility. So they just hear the eunuch, when the king says this, is he going to molest the queen? One of the eunuch walks over and he says, that's the end of that, just puts a bag over his head. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, by the way, there's a 75-foot gallows standing in Haman's house. He made it for Mordecai. Remember the man who spoke up to help the king? The king said, hang him on it. End of that. And they hauled Haman out, and whoosh, on the gallows he went. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he'd prepared for Mordecai. And the king's fury subsided. He sat at the table and drank his wine and kind of cooled off for a little while. Chapter 8, verse 1. That same day King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he'd reclaimed from Haman, as they're carrying Haman out the door. Wait a minute, wait a minute. And swoop, there goes the signet ring from his hand. and presented it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. And now, starting in verse 3, Esther has to plead with the king to reverse the edict, because remember, the edict to destroy the Judeans was written according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, so it couldn't be changed. The king just can't send out a little thing and saying, hey, I was wrong, don't destroy the Jews. There has to be a second edict issued that now empowers the Jews to defend themselves. And that's exactly what we read in verse 11. The king's edict, the second edict, granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any army force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children. And by the way, to plunder the property of their enemies. Haman had used plunder as a way to get greedy people to attack the Jews. Now, the Jews can defend themselves, and if anybody attacks them, they get the plunder of the enemies. In verse 15, Mordecai left the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. The city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, and gladness and honor. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews, because fear of the Jews had seized them. So this was a time when the Jewish nation expanded. People, oy vey, pass a bagel, give me one of those yarmulkes. Now, how do you say Lord? I mean, many of the people became Jews because of the tremendous influence of Mordecai. And at this time they established a feast. And if you look at verse 18, chapter 9, the Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, and then on the 15th they rested and made it a day of fast, feasting, and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observed the 14th of the month of the day, Adar, as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. Verse 27, the Jews took it upon themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who join them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation by every family and in every province and in every city, and these days of Purim should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, and they still are today. The Jews today still celebrate the Feast of Purim that was established at the time of Esther. In chapter 10, verse 3, and Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, held in high esteem by many fellow Jews because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. Mordecai used his influence to extend the power and prestige of the Jews in the Old Testament, and we as Christians today need to stand up for God and the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's the end of this tape. Yeah.